In a surprise move, the North Koreans invaded the Republic of South Korea on June 25, 1950. They quickly captured the South Korean capital of Seoul and within 5 weeks pushed the defenders to the southern tip of the Korean Peninsula into the Pusan perimeter. How did intelligence leaders not predict this invasion? How did the American army respond to defend South Korea? And what actions took place in Pusan? For answers to these questions and more Army History Insights, stay tuned.
Welcome to the U.S. Army History and Heritage Podcast, the official podcast of the United States Army Center of Military History. The Center of Military History writes and publishes the Army's official history, manages the U.S. Army Museum Enterprise, and provides historical support throughout the U.S. Army.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the United States Army History and Heritage Podcast. I'm Lee Reynolds, the Strategic Communications Officer for the Center of Military History. And in this episode, we're discussing the Army's role in the opening months of the Korean War. We will discuss events that led to the war and the opening battles through the defense of the Pusan perimeter in the summer of 1950. Joining me for this discussion is Army historian Dr. Peter Knight. Well, welcome back, Pete.
Thanks, Lee. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Dr. Peter Knight is the Director of the Historical Studies Directorate at the U.S. Army Center of Military History. He joined CMH after retiring from the U.S. Army as a Lieutenant Colonel after 23 years of service in the Military Intelligence Branch. In his 23 years of service, Dr. Knight served in numerous tactical and strategic level intelligence assignments, including the command of Charlie Company 102nd Military Intelligence Battalion, 2nd Infantry Division in the Republic of Korea, Foreign Intelligence Watch Officer for the U.S. Army G2, a combat tour in Iraq in 2008, where he served as an intelligence advisor to the 2nd Iraqi Army Division in Mosul, and culminating as the Deputy Commander of the 706th Military Intelligence Group at Fort Gordon, Georgia. Dr. Knight also served in two academic postings as an instructor and later assistant professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point from 2004 to 2007, and as the Army ROTC Professor of Military Science at Princeton University from 2011 to 2014. Dr. Knight is a 1994 graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and he later earned his Ph.D. in history from The Ohio State University in June of 2006. His area of historical specialization is strategic intelligence in the Korean War. Perfect for today's topic here. So he also wrote his doctoral thesis on the subject and published a chapter on intelligence in the Ashgate Research Companion to the Korean War in 2014. Dr. Knight is also the author of the revised CMH publication, The Staff Ride, Fundamentals, Experiences, and Techniques, that was published in 2020. And he's also led numerous battlefield staff rides for the U.S. Army, the Department of Defense, and congressional delegations across the globe. So that's a big list of accomplishments, Pete. But I think honing in on your experience in Korea and intelligence in Korea is going to really provide a lot of strong insights here for this discussion. So let's talk about some of these intelligence things before we get into the war itself. Can you describe the events that led, first of all, to the separation of North and South Korea after World War II, and then the actions that led to the conflict? So kind of giving us that strategic setting.
Absolutely. So Korea, also known as Chosen, the land of the morning calm, is also referred to in history as the Hermit Kingdom, as it has been forever sandwiched between the major Asian powers, Japan, China, and Russia, the former Soviet Union. Those powers have consistently clashed over time for domination of the Korean Peninsula and the Asian continent and its surrounding littoral areas. Imperial Japan annexed Korea in 1910 and ruled it with an iron grip until its defeat and surrender at the end of World War II. At that time, the victorious Allied powers, namely the U.S. and the Soviet Union, agreed to divide occupation duties on the Korean Peninsula between them to accept the surrender of Imperial Japanese forces and oversee their return to Japan and enable Korea to resume its sovereign status over time. the Soviets agreed to control the northern half of the peninsula above the 38th parallel, and the U.S. would control the southern area below the 38th parallel, a latitude line that essentially divided the peninsula in half.
And that happened because of a treaty at the end of the war?
No. There was no treaty per se, more so an agreement between the Allied powers to oversee Japan's surrender and the movement of Japanese forces out of Korea, and then to eventually restore Korean sovereignty. At least that was the idea.
Okay.
This occupation drew immediate complaint from the Korean peoples, both North and South, who wanted immediate independence. Mm-hmm. And yet Korea as a nation had become divided about its own identity and its vision for the future, and competing political factions in the North and South embraced their respective allied power brokers to try to gain a superior footing. In August of 1947, the U.S., Great Britain, and China agreed to reconsider establishment of a four-power trusteeship to facilitate the unification of Korea, but the Soviet Union refused to cooperate. And the U.S. then proposed that the United Nations supervise elections in both zones of Korea and that it oversee formation of a national government. So elections took place in Korea in May of 1948, but the North Koreans neither participated nor recognized the results of those elections. The South Koreans had chosen representatives for a national assembly of a new Republic of Korea, which then elected Syngman Rhee as its chairman. In July 1948, the assembly produced a constitution and then elected Rhee as president of the new Republic of Korea. And then at that time, U.S. Army forces in Korea, their governmental authority came to an end. And in September of 1948, the North Koreans formed their own government, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, under Kim Il-sung. Kim Il-sung was a communist guerrilla fighter who had supported Mao Zedong's communist forces in China's civil war and became a Soviet and Chinese protege groomed to assume power in North Korea and work to unify Korea under a communist-style regime. Whereas in the South, newly elected President Syngman Rhee, who's a Princeton-educated Korean statesman, aspired to unify Korea under his own auspices in a more capitalist, pro-Western type society, although Rhee himself was a bit of an authoritarian. So the Korean War, in truth, is a civil war for the nation's identity with ultimate superpower sponsorship of the competing factions.
That's interesting. I've never heard anybody put it in those terms, and I've spent a lot of time in Korea, actually, but I've never thought of it that way, as really a civil war in the way that it started. So at this point then, are there any U.S. troops in Korea?
So there were the U.S. Army forces in Korea under General John Church in the late 1940s, while they were trying to attempt to transition Korea to a sovereign government. The U.S. Occupation troops left Korea in 1949. And then the only American troops left in the area were over in Japan, the Eighth Army, that was focused largely on the occupation of Japan.
Right. And if any U.S. troops had remained there...
There is a small contingent, a 472-soldier contingent called the KMAG, which was the Korean Military Advisory Group. Their job was to help train the ROC Army and enable it to stand up on its own. The ROC Army kind of evolves from a constabulary force of about 20,000 and eventually reaches an organized army strength of about 65,000 before the war.
So no real combat troops there, just the advisors, the trainers?
Just an advisory group, exactly, that's designed to try to help the ROC Army stand up and learn how to train and defend the country.
And at this point, you know, we're into early 1950, there's no anticipation of an invasion.
No. In fact, you know, U.S. strategic planning after World War II had centered on the Soviet Union and its satellite nations. in 1950 as the most powerful member of the NATO alliance, America gave first claim of its military resources to the defense of Western Europe, mm-hmm. as opposed to the Pacific and the Far East.
Right.
In April 1948, President Harry Truman had approved a policy that no problems with Korea would be a cause for war for the United States.
Wow.
And in January of 1950, in a speech to the National Press Club here in Washington, Secretary of State Dean Acheson announced an American defensive strategy in the Far East that excluded both Korea and Formosa, present-day Taiwan.
Wow.
This no doubt emboldened the North Korean regime and its Soviet and Chinese allies.
The Korean War, especially now at the start of the war, okay, it's been called a study in unpreparedness. So with all this that you're saying now, there's didn't seem like there was any anticipation of the North wanting to attack or even perhaps what their strength was. So how did we miss that? How did American intelligence, whether it was the CIA or Army or DOD intel, not accurately predict or expect the invasion?
And you know, a lot of this, it's a function of a lot of different factors that our strategic attentions were focused elsewhere, that we had been in the midst of a drawdown from World War II, significantly reducing our forces to include our intelligence gathering capabilities as well.
And this is an era before satellites, so you know, we didn't have that.
Absolutely.
To help us. Yeah.
And you know, there also becomes a sense of complacency on the Korean Peninsula, because there were clashes, there were border clashes. Numerous clashes occurred between DPRK and ROK border constabulary forces since May of 1949. Hundreds of small-scale assaults occurred across the 38th parallel during the first half of 1950.
Now, were they both sides going at it, or is it just the North, coming towards the South?
The North certainly, in large part, was mm-hmm. coming towards the South, but at certain points, and certainly the political rhetoric of the South, you know, Syngman Rhee mm-hmm. was all about trying to unify Korea under his auspices. Mm-hmm. So there were definitely clashes both ways. By late 1949, talk of North Korean invasion was almost routine in intelligence circles, but it went largely unnoticed against the background of threatening communist activities in other parts of the world, mm-hmm. Southeast Asia, Western Europe, and the Middle East. The Far East Command's G2, Major General Charles Willoughby, did raise the possibility of a North Korean invasion as early as April in 1950, and again as late as May 1950, only to backtrack in the intervening weeks prior to the actual invasion in June, stating that an attack was unlikely and that the North Koreans would continue to employ guerrilla activity and psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm.
The officers of the Korean Military Advisory Group felt that an attack by North Korea was not imminent and that if it happened, they thought the South Koreans could repel it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Since the U.S. had no plan of any sort to counter a North Korean invasion, you know, debates about American intelligence failure regarding the attack are largely academic.
Mm.
But again, with all of the border clashes mm-hmm. that had happened in years and months prior to the actual invasion, there was a sense of complacency there that this was more the norm. These units that were moving and mm-hmm. in different places along the border was considered a normal state of affairs.
Interesting. Now, they're more like probing attacks. I mean, looking back at it now, that you know they were trying to find out weaknesses. How are they going to defend when we do attack?
Yes.
I mean,
and certainly in hindsight, you know, You can look back and see different things like, you know, moving air assets to airstrips or building airstrips closer mm-hmm. to the 38th parallel that would, in you know, certainly in hindsight, would be indicators of a buildup and the ability to range into South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But again, those things become very visible and obvious in hindsight and were not necessarily obvious to people at the time.
Describe the invasion for us. So the invasion took place on the 25th of June.
Yes.
So how were forces on both sides arrayed? What were their strengths? And I think you already addressed this, but American forces at the time, they weren't even on the peninsula except for some advisors.
Correct.
Yeah.
So American combat troops had fully withdrawn from South Korea by June of 1949, and they had left behind the advisory group, the KMAG, who had the mission to train, advise, and assist a 65,000-man ROC army that had evolved from earlier constabulary forces. In the early summer of 1950, four ROC divisions held positions along the 38th parallel, the 1st, 6th, 7th, and 8th divisions. The 17th Regiment of the ROC Army's Capital Division was on the western extreme of the Ongjin Peninsula and were the first to face North Korean invading elements. The other four ROC divisions were scattered about the interior and southernmost parts of the country. The headquarters of the Capital Division was in Seoul, the 2nd Division near Taejon, and the 3rd Division at Daegu, and the 5th at Gwangju in southwest Korea. When U.S. Armed Forces withdrew from South Korea in 1949, they transferred enough equipment to the ROC Army sufficient for a 50,000-man army. The weapons of the ROC divisions along the 38th parallel included M1 carbine rifles, 60 and 81-millimeter mortars, 2.36-inch rocket launchers, and M3 105-millimeter howitzer artillery.
So basically World War II equipment.
Indeed. Army forces had no tanks, no medium-range artillery, and no fighter aircraft or bombers.
What about anti-tank weapons?
Just the rocket launchers, and really those were largely ineffective against Soviet T-34 tanks. The ROC Army also had 830 2.5-ton trucks and 1,300 Jeeps, and their air assets were just 12 liaison aircraft and 10 trainer aircraft. The ROC Navy had a sprinkling of small vessels that included patrol craft with mine layers and minesweepers. The North Korean People's Army, in contrast, had been stood up in February of 1948. Wow. The Soviets exercised close control over its organization and training, and the Soviet advisors worked directly with the units. In 1948, there were 150 Soviet advisors assigned to each division. That number dropped to 20 per division in 1949 and to a lesser number down to just the corps level in 1950. By June 1950, the NKPA and its border constabulary units numbered 135,000 men.
Wow.
This included 8 full-strength infantry divisions of 11,000 men each, 2 more half-strength infantry divisions, a separate infantry regiment, and a motorcycle reconnaissance regiment and an armored brigade. The NKPA benefited from some 20,000 North Koreans who were veterans of the Chinese Civil War in the late 1940s and brought combat-hardened quality and efficiency to the units as a result. The Armored Brigade had Soviet T-34 tanks, a mainstay of the Soviet Armored Force in World War II. These tanks weighed 32 tons and had an 85-millimeter gun. The Soviets also provided artillery pieces, 76 and 122-millimeter howitzers, 45-millimeter anti-tank guns, and 82 and 120-millimeter mortars. The NKPA had 180 Soviet aircraft, 60 Yak trainers, 40 Yak fighters, 70 attack bombers, and 10 reconnaissance planes. The North Korean Navy had only a few small vessels, patrol craft, coastal steamers. But from 15 to 24 June 1950, the North Korean High Command assembled some 90,000 men, 7 infantry divisions, the armored brigade, a separate infantry regiment, the motorcycle regiment, and a border constabulary brigade supported by 150 Soviet T-34 tanks near the 38th parallel. So at 0400 on 25 June, the North Korean Army launched a coordinated attack across the 38th parallel that ran from coast to coast.
Wow.
The nearest American combat troops were located in Japan, where they were more focused on occupation duty rather than training for combat. The Far East Command had 4 tactical divisions and a regimental combat team. They had the 1st Cav Division, the 7th, 24th, and 25th Infantry Divisions, and the 29th Regimental Combat Team, all under operational command of 8th Army Commander Lieutenant General Walton Walker.
Wow. So United States Army or any forces in general, just not available. And like you said, they're focusing on occupation duty. So they have not really been doing combat training.
Indeed. And they were not at 100% strength, not by any stretch.
Oh, wow.
Most of them were 70, 80% at best.
Mm-hmm. And in Korea, you said that it was from East Coast to West Coast. The invasion just came down
actually from the West Coast side first and mm-hmm. then to the East, but yeah. all across the parallel.
So in the West, because a lot, or I would say most of Korea is mountainous. So there's no, you can't get armor in a lot of Korea, but you have that, what's called the Wijongbu Corridor.
Indeed.
That comes down on the west side from basically Seoul up really to North Korea.
Yes.
So yep. I'm imagining that's where the major thrust was initially because, yep. you know, Seoul was the big...
The Kaesong-Munsong Corridor and the Chorwon Valley approaches were the high-speed avenues of approach. As you mm-hmm. said, the mountains, the Taebaek mountain range, which bisects the peninsula in the northern sector, trails down and moves along the east coast mm-hmm. of the peninsula once you get south of the 38th parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And so they tended to... That's more of the economy of force mission as they're moving south, where they're going to use primarily the high-speed avenues we described
right.
as they invade.
So describe the invasion briefly. You know, the North Koreans come in. How effective were they? And, you know, we know they took Seoul pretty quick. How long did that actually take?
Yes. So with the start of the invasion on the 25th, they will have captured Seoul within 72 hours of launching the invasion.
Wow.
The only thing that's going to slow them down, of course, is the Han River that mm-hmm. runs along and through the capital city and just to the south of it. And the South Koreans will blow most of the bridges over the Han River.
Mm-hmm.
And so the North Koreans are going to have to pause and consolidate and reconstruct some of those bridges in order to begin their advance southward. But it won't take them very long do that.
I'm sure they were prepared to do that, their engineering assets. They must have anticipated the blowing of the bridges.
Yes.
Yeah. And then they continued south. At what point then did the Americans or the world respond to this? What was the American political and military response, and how quickly was the U.S. able to send combat forces to Korea?
Indeed, the response is relatively quick. Following the North Korean invasion on 25 June, the United Nations Security Council, minus the Soviets who boycotted the council for its refusal to seat communist China at the table, had met and passed a resolution that called on North Korea to cease hostilities and withdraw back to the 38th parallel. Mm-hmm. President Truman immediately authorized ships and airplanes to protect the evacuation of American dependents from Korea and allowed the use of American air and naval assets to support the Republic of Korea below the 38th parallel.
Oh, that's an interesting, just below the 38th parallel.
Not wanting to risk, obviously, escalating the war.
Mm.
On 27 June, the UN Security Council passed another resolution that recommended UN members assist the ROC in repelling the invasion. The Joint Chiefs of Staff authorized General MacArthur to assume operational control of all American military activities in Korea. MacArthur sent the General Headquarters Advance Command and Liaison Group in Korea, led by Brigadier General John Church, from Japan to South Korea to administer the KMAG and assist the ROC Army. MacArthur then flew personally to Korea on the 29th of June to assess the situation and urge the immediate commitment of American ground forces. President Truman authorized commitment of American troops to secure the port of Pusan and a nearby air base and approved sending two army divisions from Japan to Korea and the establishment of a naval blockade of North Korea.
Hmm.
The ROC capital Seoul fell to the NKPA on the 28th of June, but by 4 July, North Korean forces consolidated and repaired the blown rail bridges over the Han River to continue their drive to the south. In Tokyo, Lieutenant General Walton Walker, the 8th Army commander, ordered Major General William F. Dean, the commander 24th Infantry Division, to send a 500-man delaying force to Korea immediately. This battalion-level task force was led by Lieutenant Colonel Charles Bradford Smith and became known as Task Force Smith.
Right.
It was the 1st Battalion, 21st Infantry, augmented with the 52nd Field Artillery Battalion, and he would pick up a position 3 miles to the north of Osan on the 5th of July to attempt to halt the North Korean
advance. This is a 500-man task force, just 500 men, okay.
It's something that they could deploy quickly.
Yeah, and did they have? I mean, knowing what the what they were going to counter, did they have effective anti-tank weapons with them?
No, they did not.
No,
they were badly outnumbered, as you might imagine. Task Force Smith confronted two regiments of the NKPA's 4th Division that was and that division had 33 T-34 tanks with it. With no armor or effective anti-tank weaponry, Task Force Smith was quickly overrun and sustained 50% casualties
in
that engagement. Yeah. From then on, Task Force Smith obviously becomes a lesson in the dangers of military unpreparedness. You're taking a unit that's been on occupation duty and you're throwing it in against the onslaught of a very well-trained, highly motivated infantry armor group that is vastly superior in strength and assets without any appropriate weaponry to be able to counter that.
Well, was there any concern on the North Koreans' part or the Soviets' part that we're now facing American combat forces? Was there any hesitation on their part?
At this stage of the game, no. I mean, I think they had gone in with the assumption that the U.S. probably wouldn't care enough about Korea to intervene, but they were mistaken, obviously, in that assumption. And President Truman certainly did not hesitate to commit forces when he thought they were needed.
So they didn't let the American presence there stop their
They're continuing to roll, and they're probably banking on the fact that they're not going to be able that America is not going to be able to get enough troop strength in quickly enough to stop the invasion.
Yeah, I mean, at the pace it was going, you wouldn't think so. But now, you know, I understand that this, you know, it comes under United Nations command at some point. So, first of all, when does that happen, and which countries become part of this UN command?
Absolutely. So, you know, obviously, by the time that Task Force Smith has had its engagement, General MacArthur is ordering General Walker to set up 8th Army headquarters in Taegu and assume operational command of the ground campaign to include all U.S. and ROC Army forces under a single command. In the meantime, on 7 July 1950, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution recommending a unified command be established in the Republic of Korea. President Truman then appointed General of the Army Douglas MacArthur as the commanding general of United Nations Command.
Well, I got a question on that, though. How could they do that when the Soviet Union was a member of the Security Council?
Because they essentially were abstaining, right? They're not voting per se. So there's still enough of a quorum, if you will, to allow them to pass the
strategic
resolution.
Mistake on their part. Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, that could have changed the whole face of this if they had voted, because one no vote meant that
the UN couldn't have
done anything.
But, you know, for all that was going on in trying to get Communist China a seat at the table—
It
made for an interesting dynamic. Yeah. And of course, you know, the Soviet advisors are helping the North Korean army, at least in some limited capacity at this point. But President Truman, as I said, appointed General MacArthur to command the United Nations Command. Initially, the U.S. and ROC forces made up the command. However, 22 other nations would eventually contribute forces. 16 nations would send combat troops. Okay. U.S., the U.K., Canada, Turkey, Australia, the Philippines, Thailand, Netherlands, Colombia, Greece, New Zealand, Ethiopia, Belgium, France, South Africa, and Luxembourg. Mm. And then five nations would send medical units or assets, those being Sweden, Norway, Denmark, India, and Italy.
It basically became UN Command, but it was really the United States that was
So you have United Nations Command, and then, of course, MacArthur and his staff of the U.S. Far East Command form the majority of that, right? And it's particularly at the headquarters in Tokyo, was that same staff, sent largely an army staff.
Now that we have the unified command over there, more forces are starting to pour in. I think we've got the 24th, the 25th Infantry Division, the 1st Cavalry. So how does this affect the battle? And talk a little bit about, you know, with the failures of Task Force Smith, what are they being sent over with? What equipment? What are they bringing? Armor? Are they bringing anti-armor? Was it infantry? And was it enough?
MacArthur's strategy in the early stages of the Korean War was first to stop the NKPA advance mm-hmm. and then use naval and air superiority to support an amphibious operation in their rear. But once he got over to Korea and observed just how formidable the North Korean People's Army was, he told the Joint Chiefs of Staff that in order to halt and reverse the invasion, he would need 4 to 4.5 full-strength infantry divisions, an airborne regimental combat team, and an armored group of 3 medium tank battalions and reinforcing artillery assets. And then at that point, the JCS did all they could to give him that.
So they were all in. The country was all in on this.
So what this is going to entail, of course, while he has 3 divisions there in Japan, mm-hmm. as I said before, they're not at full strength. Yeah. So number one, we got to get those divisions to full strength. And then you got to send over additional division. And the most readily available was the Marines. Mm-hmm. First Provisional Marine Brigade, and then eventually the 1st Marine Division will be the ones that come from the continental United States, in addition to those troops that are plussing up the 24th, 25th, and 1st Cav Divisions.
And do we have naval aircraft carriers or task forces in the area, too, that were supporting this?
Indeed, naval task forces. And of course, with the North Korean invasion, the other concern is this a part of a larger move? Will the Chinese try to move forces into Korea, or will they try to make a move on Formosa?
Oh, yeah.
So they had to move naval assets to intervene in between mainland China and Formosa as a safeguard as well.
So at this point, they're anticipating it could be a much larger conflict.
It's hard to say, you know, and part of the paranoia also was this some sort of diversion in as a prelude to an even larger movement against Western Europe?
Oh, wow.
They were thinking through all possible contingencies and what this might
be. And they should. Definitely. And you talked about, you know, there was concern that the Chinese might get involved there in Korea. But with all the support, the equipment, the training from the Soviet Union, was there any concern that the Soviets might send forces in?
That, I guess, was always a lingering question. But the Soviets had withdrawn, you know, their troops, and their advisory footprint in North Korea was actually very small at the time. And that was by design, because the Soviets didn't want to provoke a larger engagement either. But again, you know, everyone was thinking that this, to make a move in this particular area, specifically the Soviets doing this, they figured that what North Korea had done, they only could have done with a Soviet blessing.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And that was, in fact, the case, that Kim Il-sung had gone to Joe Stalin and had asked permission to invade and asked for Soviet support.
Mm-hmm.
But Stalin was very careful to limit the amount of support that he would provide directly.
Right.
And was more interested in having Communist China help out to give him a bit of distance.
All right. We've got more U.S. troops coming over, but they're not really impacting the push south until they get to the, it's called the Naktong area, or what we now call the Pusan perimeter. So can you explain what happened here?
So as Lieutenant General Walton Walker assumes command of the ground campaign in Korea, he inherited troop formations that were essentially trading space for time to enable more UN troops to arrive. But at a certain point, there was no more available trade space.
Mm-hmm.
In order to protect the port of Pusan and nearby airfields, they had to stop the North Korean progress. So by the 29th of July, Walton Walker issues a stand or die order to the 8th Army.
Stand or die.
Emphasizing that the retreating must stop.
Mm-hmm.
NKPA forces relentlessly continued their attacks. And on the 1st of August, 8th Army issued an operational directive to all UN ground forces in Korea for their planned withdrawal east of the Naktong River. UN units would then establish main defensive positions behind what became known as the Pusan Perimeter. The intent was to draw the line on retreating and holding off the NKPA while the U.S. built up enough combat power to wage a counteroffensive. By the 4th of August, UN forces established a rectangular area about 100 miles north to south and 50 miles east to west The Nakdong River formed the western boundary, except for the southernmost 15 miles on the west side, where the Nakdong flowed east after its confluence with the Nam River. The ocean formed both the southern and eastern boundaries of the perimeter. Wow. Preservation of the Port of Pusan was paramount to enable more U.S. and U.N. troop flows into Korea.
They put up a really good stand there and were able, finally, to stop the North Korean advance. And how long, you said this was the end of July, beginning of August, I think, that the Pusan perimeter was really established.
Yes.
Right. And what was the fighting like there for the next several weeks?
The fighting was very intense, and the North Koreans pressed along every available avenue of approach. Walton Walker's 8th Army seemed to face an impossible task, but thanks to United Nations air and naval superiority and the help of American communications intelligence, signals intelligence, Walker was able to interdict the elongating logistical lines of the NKPA, and based on SIGINT tip-offs, he was able to vector UN forces to different hotspots on the perimeter where those tip-offs indicated imminent NKPA attacks.
Yeah.
The North Koreans were not great about OPSEC or communication security.
Well, that's good.
And we happened to come across some NKPA code books that aided us in getting inside their communications networks. And that communications intelligence also provided valuable feedback on the effects of UN airstrikes in wreaking havoc on the North Korean supply lines. We were able to also find out that they were having ammunition or food shortages or fuel shortages.
Oh, good.
So this helped us understand their posture and perhaps where they might be vulnerable to counterattack at some future point.
Yeah, so at this point, end of August into early to mid-September, we're basically at a stalemate. Really, at the Pusan perimeter, is that a good way to describe that?
Well, we're at a point where we're able to hold. We're able to hold on and build up more combat power.
Right.
And with that situation stabilizing, now MacArthur's staff is getting going on planning the amphibious assault to help eventually reverse the tide of the North Korean invasion.
Right.
And that'll be the landing at Incheon.
At Incheon, right. And we're going to get into that in our next podcast. So this is this has been fascinating, very interesting subject. And it's interesting, you know, talking with you here, that how much larger of a war this could have been. But anyway, so now we're here in the Pusan perimeter, and well, we'll end it there for this one, unless you have anything else to add about the battle. Otherwise, we'll just talk about our Hua trivia.
Yeah, I've pretty much covered the scope of this of this podcast. But for the Hua trivia piece, I'll just say that for the Korean War, this is where we begin to see the gradual racial integration of American military units based on Executive Order 9981 signed by President Harry Truman on July 26, 1948. In 1950, the Army agrees to full integration across the service and abolishes the enlistment quota for African Americans. By the end of the Korean War, most of the military was integrated, with the last segregated Army units being dissolved by 1954.
The order was there, but the Army was slow to implement. But the Korean War created a necessity.
Absolutely.
And like you're saying, by the end of the war, it was almost fully integrated, right? It took a few more years. But I think it was in the different compos, right? Like National Guard to really fully implement.
Yeah.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, for your insights today about the Korean War. And if anyone wants to learn more about the Army in the Korean War or learn more about Army history in general, then I encourage you to explore our website at history.army.mil. And if you want to experience Army history every day, then visit our social media sites on Facebook, X, and Instagram. So thanks for joining us today on the United States Army History and Heritage Podcast. For the Center of Military History, I'm Lee Reynolds. And until next time, we're history.
The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views,
policies, or opinions of the U.S. Army or Department of Defense. For more information about the Army's proud history and heritage, go to history.army.mil.